read God's description of an animal that he created as the crescendo of them all. What was his point? Nothing short of showing us and Job that we don't have a clue what God knows and what he's capable of accomplishing. One verse we read that sounds to some who don't believe in the creation story sounds to them as a fairy tale. Job chapter 41, verses 18 through 21, speaking of Leviathan, his sneezes flash forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning torches. Did we read that correctly? Out of his mouth go burning torches. Sparks of fire leap forth. Out of his nostrils smoke goes forth, as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals, and a flame goes forth from his mouth. In this verse, God clearly describes the highlight of Leviathan's characteristics. And it makes my jaw drop thousands of years after he said them. And I must confess that when it comes to creatures described by the Revelation letter, for instance, that are obvious to me to be symbolic of a deeper idea, I really just stop trying too hard to grasp those. Sorry, it's just too much symbolism, and it's fine to study them, but for me, I just don't want to try to focus too hard on that. But I know God has the power, you see, to create any creature he desires to create. He could come up with any number of fanciful, weird animals. After all, he created a hippopotamus, didn't he? I mean, this guy's not going to win any races. He's not sleek. He's not aerodynamic. What was he thinking when he did that? And so are you like me and convinced that God has a sense of humor? And I think the VBS song about the hippopotamus kind of reiterates that. On the other hand, Leviathan is not mythical or symbolic because the context of the writing of chapters 38 through 41 of Job is descriptive of real things. They only sound unreal because we've never seen them. And the ending of the crescendo of his talk to Job are the things that make no sense to us because we haven't seen them. God's whole point is, I created these things, you did not. For Leviathan to be described with the ability to produce smoke and fire at will, whenever he feels like it, from his nose and his mouth is just fascinating and kind of scary. However scary it might have been, this animal forces us, because we just don't have enough time in this slot, it forces us to stay with this theme this week. What about dragons? And the first instance that I find the English word dragon in the King James Version in Scripture was in Nehemiah. Nehemiah 2, verse 13. And this is the King James Version of it. And I went out by night by the gate of the valley, even before the dragon well, and to the dung port, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and the gates thereof were consumed with fire. Now, it might interest you, and it might not, but the way I learned to study the Bible is pretty simple, if not boring to some. While studying a passage, I see a word that I want to focus on, in this case, dragons. It's in the Scripture. What's it about? So I want to know more about that. And I turn to the scholars who know more than I do, since I am a one-language man. Bless y'all who are more than one. And I use a concordance, such as Strong's Concordance or others. And I try to get a grasp of what the original Hebrew or Greek word or whatever language was for King James rendering of it, such as dragons. I also turned to multiple translations to see if the word or phrase or the sentence changes any in the separate translator's pair of eyes, so to speak. So for the word dragon in Nehemiah, here is Strong's information. It comes from Strong's numbers, the words in the King James, and all of them, by the way, 8577. If you can read Hebrew, there is your Hebrew, very small letters, but you can see it, or characters. The transliteration is tanin, the pronunciation is tanin, and there's several things that you can pick up on here. It tells you root words, it tells you what the word is derived from, and other Hebrew words, but the small and the short of it is the words in the King James were 21 times the word dragon was used for this Hebrew word, 3 times the word serpent, 3 times the word whale, 1 was a sea monster, and so for a total of 28 times. And I like that. So we can look and see that the synonyms for this word in Hebrew, for us to read it in English, is a marine or land monster, a sea serpent, or don't understand this part, but a jackal. So who knows? So a dragon, a sea monster, a serpent, a whale. And a concordance definition doesn't always drill deep enough. To help me, this simple one language man, understand the passage. So the context of the passage and a comparative read of some or all of the times that the Bible uses the word is needed. And lastly, I'll dig into a commentary to get another guy's take on it. Why would the word dragon stand out to me? Well, I mean, it's something we haven't seen in our lifetime. It is an animal, a creature that we don't have anymore. At least we think we don't. And entertain me for a minute. If I had my way and I could translate the Bible into the Kephart translation. If you don't know me, that's my last name. So we're just going to have the Kephart translation. I would find verses like Nehemiah, and I would exchange those words and insert the word dinosaur. I would just do it, just because it's not in there. And it's the biggest thing since sliced bread. All you have to do is mention dinosaurs to the public, and everybody's ears perk, especially the children. And the Bible would get so much more exposure if the Kephart translation included the word dinosaurs. And you might be wondering, why is the word dinosaur not a biblical word? Well, they explained to me that fossils were not found or paid attention to very much, more than just saying, hey, there's a good doorstop, let's use that. Until about 1840 or 1850, and the dates are different on different websites. And this is one caption I found. In the summer of 1858, Victorian gentleman and fossil hobbyist William Parker Folk was vacationing in Haddonfield, New Jersey. You know, got anybody in Haddonfield from Haddonfield, New Jersey? I've never heard of it. When he heard that 20 years previous, workers had found gigantic bones in a local marl pit, Folk spent the late summer and fall directing a crew of hired diggers shin deep in gray slime. That sounds like a great job, right? Eventually, he found the bones of an animal larger than an elephant with structural features of both a lizard and a bird. And so Hadrosaurus was born. And if you look at the rendering of it, they have called this the duck-billed dinosaur. This was the first dinosaur fossil that was considered complete or nearly complete. And earlier in the 19th century, single bones or a few teeth were found here and there. And so if they found one somewhere, then it would just be by itself. And they would take it off and it wouldn't be researched anymore. And the rest of the fossil wasn't located. The term dinosaur then was only invented in 1841. And so it stands to reason that people interested in dinosaurs possibly haven't considered the Bible as a source to read about them. If we read about animals in the Bible described as dinosaurs, we then can actually have another ammunition to debunk the old earth theory or argument, if you will. In case of the behemoth, as we said last time, that people have said, well, that's a hippopotamus. And then the Leviathan, and some people have said that that's a crocodile. The commentators and Bible scholars' explanations weren't helpful because they seemed to explain away some clear statements that didn't match what I'm able to discern from the reading on my own. I mean, that's why I went to English, to understand what words mean. And even my favorite commentator, Brother Kaufman, went along with some others, many others, saying behemoth was a hippo. And he said this even though the verse said that the hippopotamus, behemoth, swings his tail like a cedar. It's important for each follower of God to dive into his word with some level of this curiosity, and that's why I brought up how I have learned to study the Bible, to understand the Bible, to understand God a little bit better. And it just begs our attention to remember Acts 17 and verse 11, "These were more noble-minded than those in Thessalonica, for they received the word with great eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see whether these things were so." What things? These things about the gospel, these things about the Messiah that they haven't heard about. And so they examined to see if these teachings were true. Remember, Nehemiah called the location the dragon well. According to biblicalcyclopedia.com, there was this description, and it gave the Hebrew word. And you noticed that for dragon in Hebrew was tanin. They put some whatever you call the words in front of that word tanin, and I don't know exactly the pronunciation, but Enhat Tanin, or fountain of the dragon. And this was the name of a fountain situated opposite or near the valley gate of Jerusalem. According to Nehemiah 2 and 13, it is probably identical with the modern upper pool of Gihon on the northwestern side of the city, and also the serpent's pool mentioned by Josephus. This may be the modern Warren's Shaft, which is a common tour of Jerusalem today. Please show me, anybody been there? Anybody in the room been there? So I only know what I watched on a 5-minute YouTube video, so you know how much of an expert I am. But it just made me want to go more. And my point in including this passage in Nehemiah is that the writer mentioned the name of the well that was known to them at the time. Why did they use that term? Why did they call it that? Who knows, but it was a name that they used in that day and time. And if we were the only example, if it were the only example, we'd be truly scratching our heads, wouldn't we? But there's more. Psalms 91, we find a verse that Satan quotes from when he is tempting Jesus in the wilderness in Matthew 4. Matthew 91, verses 10 through 12, "There shall no evil befall thee, neither shall any plague come nigh thy dwelling. For he shall give his angels charge over thee to keep thee in all thy ways. They shall bear thee up in their hands, lest thou dash thy foot against a stone." Interestingly enough, old crafty Satan, he left out a verse. You would think he would, wouldn't you? In verse 13, "Thou shalt tread upon the lion and the adder," or a snake, "the young lion and the dragon shalt thou trample under feet." New American Standard renders this word serpent for dragon. Of course, here's the usage of the word, tanin, dragon, that sounds like we can correlate with the Genesis prophecy from God regarding the seed of Eve in Genesis chapter 3 that is going to crush the head of the serpent. And at least we can see the tie by going to the context of both passages. And if you can correct me if you disagree. But I learned in my Isaiah class in preaching school that the book of Isaiah contains the most prophecies concerning Jesus of all the Old Testament passages or books. All of Isaiah 27, to me, appears to be a prophecy of the Lord and the church and possibly the judgment. But notice verse 1, in that day the Lord will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, with his fierce and great and mighty sword. Even Leviathan, the twisted serpent, and he will kill the dragon who lives in the sea. Is this a prophecy about Christ defeating Satan? Possibly, but here's another example of the word being used, and it seems to be a reference to the same Leviathan, the dragon. Interesting, just interesting. Then we get to Jeremiah chapter 51 and verse 34. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, hath devoured me. He hath crushed me. He hath made me an empty vessel. He hath swallowed me up like a dragon. New American Standard changes that word to monster. Doesn't sound like any kind of a small animal that we have tamed today. Yes, sir.
Dragons are found today in an island in the South Sea.
You know, I read a caption about that, but I wasn't sure about it, so I didn't dig into that. But I have heard that that there was. And are you talking about like?
I don't know if it's the same animal we're talking about here or not.
Right. Right. We have more. This is going to be interesting because you won't believe the external evidence as well. But it's interesting to me that God told Job Leviathan was only able to be defeated by his creator. Nothing else would touch him. And Satan is symbolized as the dragon. We can see that pretty easily in the Revelation letter and maybe even some of these Old Testament prophecies. And Satan can only be defeated by and through Jesus Christ. We can defeat him, but only because we have the blood of Christ with us and applied to us. But our focus, our for lack of time, must stay away from the symbolic side of things because we want to look at the possible validity for real dragons, just like the gentleman talked about the dragons on an island. Because dragons are, in my mind, the same as dinosaurs, however different sizes we are talking about. The Hadrosaurus was only really about 10 feet tall at the hips, so it's not like something as big as Leviathan was. And really, dinosaurs are the same as the dragons in my mind. And we shouldn't be fooled to think that dinosaurs were less than real animals. And interestingly enough, studying for this, I noticed that the people at Apologetics Press had heard over and over again that their preachers said dinosaurs are not real. And I have trouble with that. And so here is a good reason why we bring them up now. There are plenty of passages in Daniel and Revelation to study that symbolic side of things deeper. But you can get someone else to dig into that because I like my sanity. But what about evidence outside of the Bible? Apologetics Press has a book that's well worth the read, and you can read the whole thing online, Dinosaur Delusion, by Eric Lyons and Kyle Butt. Indeed, a wide variety of stories of large reptiles have been passed down through the ages from cultures all over the world. Many of these creatures sound very much like dinosaurs or dinosaur-like, and they put in parentheses marine or flying reptiles, like the Plesiosaurus and the Pterodactyl. Stories told previously before the name dinosaur was coined, and they were called fearfully great reptiles, could not have included the word dinosaur. Instead, the name attached to these creatures was dragon, just like we've been pointing out. Some dragon legends have surely been embellished over time, just like I caught a fish and it was, how big was it, you know? Well, it didn't quite have a tape measure, but it was this long. And so think about the historical accounts. Marco Polo was actually an explorer, if you weren't up to speed. It's not just a swimming pool hide-and-seek game. He traveled to China and lived there for 17 years in the 1200s. So we're not talking about ancient history, prehistoric. We're talking about in our history. And here was a caption from him. You're not going to believe this. I just think it's fascinating. Here are seen huge serpents, 10 paces in length. Have you got a figure in your mind about how long that is? That would be around 30 feet. And then 10 spans in the girth of the body. At the forefront, or the forepart, near the head, they have 2 short legs, having 3 claws like those of a tiger. Yes, I know tigers have 5 claws, but give him some credit. I'm not sure about what he meant by that. And with eyes larger than a 4-penny loaf, I don't know exactly what that means, but you can imagine. And very glaring. The jaws are wide enough to swallow a man. The teeth are large and sharp, and their whole appearance is so formidable that neither man nor any kind of animal can approach them without terror. Others are met with of a smaller size, being 8, 6, or 5 paces long. So we're talking as much as 25 feet long or 24 feet long. And the following method is used for taking them. Now this is interesting. So you think about, I don't want to approach this serpent, this dragon, this thing face to face, but here you go. In the daytime, by reason of the great heat, they lurk in caverns, from whence at night they issue to seek their food, and whatever beast they meet with and can lay hold of, whether tiger, wolf, or any other, they devour. After which they drag themselves towards some lake, spring of water, or river in order to drink. By their motion in this way along the shore and their vast weight, they make a deep impression as if a heavy beam has been drawn along the sands. Those whose employment it is to hunt them observe the track by which they are most frequently accustomed to go and fix into the ground several pieces of wood armed with sharp iron spikes, which they cover with the sand in such a manner as to not be perceptible. When therefore the animals make their way across or towards the places they usually haunt, they are wounded by these instruments and speedily killed. The crows, as soon as they perceive them to be dead, set up their scream, and this serves as a signal to the hunters, who advance to the spot and proceed to separate the skin from the flesh. All right, and notice taking care immediately to secure the gall, which is most highly esteemed in medicine. In cases of the bite of a mad dog, a pennyweight of it dissolved in wine is administered. It is also useful in accelerating parturition when the labor pains of women have come on, a small quantity of it being applied to carbuncles, pustules, or other eruptions on the body. They are presently dispersed, and it is efficacious in many other complaints. Here's a good one. The flesh also of the animal is sold at a dear rate, being thought to have a higher flavor than other kinds of meat, and by all persons it is esteemed a delicacy. So have you ever in your life, who all has heard this line or read this before? I just think it's fascinating. So we move on. There was another character who lived in the year 23 to 79 A.D., Gaius Plinius Secundus. Tradition has it that he died after he was overcome by the fumes of the Mount Vesuvius eruption. He was a philosopher, Roman philosopher, author, naturalist. He spent his time studying, writing, or investigating nature, and also was a naval and army commander. He said elephants breed in that part of Africa. And these are very unique spellings, so if I flub up, you'll know why the Africa is not even spelled the same as you would expect. Which lying beyond the, talking about Africa, lying beyond the deserts, India bringing forth the biggest, also the dragons that are continually at variance with them and evermore fighting. And those of such greatness that can easily clasp and wind round about the elephants, and withal tie them fast with a knot. In this conflict they die, both the one and the other. The elephant, he falls down dead as conquered, and with his heavy weight crushes the and squeezeth the dragon that is wound and wreathed about him. In chapter 12 he says, the dragons wear hereof, entangle and snarl his feet and legs, first with their tail, and the elephants on the other side undo those knots with their trunk as with a hand. The principal thing the dragons make at is the eye. Now these dragons are so big with all that they be able to receive all the elephant's blood. Thus they are sucked dry until they fall down dead. In chapter 13 he says, in Ethiopia there be as great dragons bred as in India, namely 20 cubits long, so around 30 feet. And it just gets better and better. I just think it's fascinating. Herodotus, if you've ever looked to Herodotus for some historical evidence or external evidence from the Bible, I've looked at his writings before too. He lived from 484 to 420 BC, they believe. And he was a well-respected Greek researcher. Herodotus wrote, there is a place in Arabia, situated very near the city of Buto, I know where that is, and to which I went on hearing of some winged serpents. And when I arrived there, I saw bones and spines of serpents in such quantities as it would be impossible to describe. It is reported that that at the beginning of spring, winged serpents fly from Arabia towards Egypt, but that ibises, that's a bird if you're not familiar, meet them at the pass and do not allow the serpents to go by, but kill them. The form of the serpent is like that of the water snake, but he has wings without feathers and as like as possible to the wings of a bat. In his third volume, Herodotus goes on to tell how these animals could sometimes be found in Arabia, Arabian spice groves. He describes their size, their coloration, even their reproduction. And then Josephus, you're familiar with Josephus possibly from studying. He was a Jewish historian who actually ended up working for the Roman Empire. But he describes the time of Moses. Moses prevented the enemies and took and led his army before those enemies were apprised of his attacking them. For he did not march by the river, but by land, where he gave a wonderful demonstration of his sagacity, his wisdom, his shrewdness. For when the ground was difficult to be passed over because of the multitude of serpents, which it produces, it being the country, I think, or the land of the people, produces in vast numbers, and indeed in singular in some of those productions, which other countries do not breed, and yet such are worse than others in power and mischief, and an unusual fierceness of sight, some of which ascend out of the ground unseen, speaking of the serpents, and also fly in the air, and so come upon men at unawares and do them mischief. Moses invented a wonderful stratagem to preserve the army safe and without hurt, for he made baskets and filled them with these ibes, those birds, and carried them along with them, with which animal is the greatest enemy to serpents imaginable, for they fly from them when they come near them, and as they fly they are caught and devoured by them as if it were done by the harts. Josephus Flavius, book 2, chapter 10, and so it's just great information. Information that I think is valuable to some information we see in the scripture. I read other stories also of the winged flying serpents rushing out of the marshes of Arabia and being intercepted by the ibis birds in midair and slaughtered by them, not allowing them to cross the border of Egypt. So it wasn't just that one instance. I read another instance of it as well. Matthew Henry referenced the serpents biting the children of Israel in the wilderness. Have you ever thought about what kind of serpents were they? What did they look like? Numbers chapter 21, 4 through 9. Here we have the New American Standard Version of it. Then they set out from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the people became impatient because of the journey. And the people spoke against God and Moses. Bad career move, by the way. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and we loathe this miserable food. Verse 6, and the Lord sent fiery serpents. King James calls it the same thing, fiery serpents. Young's literal translation calls that burning serpents. Among the people, and they bit the people, so that many people of Israel died. So the people, verse 7, came to Moses and said, we have sinned because we have spoken against the Lord, and you intercede with the Lord that he may remove the serpents from us. And Moses interceded for the people. Then the Lord said to Moses, make a fiery serpent and set it on a standard. And it shall come about that everyone who is bitten, when he looks at it, he shall live. And Moses made a bronze serpent and set it on the standard. And it came about that if a serpent bit any man, when he looked on the bronze serpent, he lived. Now, I read some and it didn't make my notes, but I read some other information that described those bites, that if they got bit on a limb, that they just had to cut that limb off. I mean, it was bad enough that they knew they had to amputate soon before it got to the rest of the body. So you can imagine the struggle that was far greater than just, oh, they got bit and they died, you know. We have this other caption. It has been suggested by certain Bible scholars over the years that the creature referenced here may be the flying serpents. Comments, if you want to look to Numbers chapter 21, and he references a biblical commentator named Gill in 1766, of all things. Artists have depicted these serpents as flying in various old manuscript illustrations, and this was from Matthew Henry in his commentary on the whole Bible. He said, they, Israel, had impudently flown in the face of God himself, and the poison of asps was under their lips, and now these fiery serpents, which it should seem, he's doing a parenthetical statement here, which it should seem were flying serpents, according to or referencing Isaiah 14 and 29, flew in their faces and poisoned them. I like this artist's rendering of that scene, and they showed serpents with wings on this plate that he did. Time Life reported how one ancient Chinese emperor of the Song Dynasty in A.D. 1000 to A.D. 1300, so 2nd century, is said to have raised a dragon in his palace. I mean, that's interesting. According to a chronicle in Canterbury Cathedral around A.D. 1449, still 2nd century, Englishmen reported seeing two fire-breathing dragons engaged in a fierce hour-long struggle. One was black while the other was reddish and spotted. In her book, British Dragons, Jacqueline Simpson brings to light several dragon legends, including one that in 1866 reported to have originally occurred in 1405, 2nd century. So close to the town of Burris, near Sudbury, there has lately appeared to the great herd of the countryside a dragon, vast in body, with a crested head, teeth like a saw, and a tail, extending to an enormous length. Having slaughtered the shepherd of a flock, did you catch that? I didn't even catch it till I read it the third time. Slaughtered the shepherd of a flock, and then it devoured many sheep. There came forth in order to shoot at him with arrows the workmen of the Lord on whose estate he had concealed himself, being Sir Richard de Waldegrave, who was a knight. But the dragon's body, although struck by the archers, remained unhurt, for the arrows bounced off his back as if it were iron or hard rock. Those arrows that fell upon the spine of his back gave out as they struck. As they struck it, a ringing of tinkling sound. Her words, not mine. Just as if they had hit a brazen plate, and they flew away off by reason of the hide of this great beast being impenetrable. So the people flew, you see. Thereupon, in order to destroy him, all the country people around were summoned. But when the dragon saw that he was again about to be assailed with arrows, he fled into a marsh or a mere, and there hid himself among the long reeds and was no more to be seen. So we have an example in this historical writing that just boggles my mind. Although some will continue to dismiss all dragons as purely mythical or purely mythical creatures, the widely purported eyewitness accounts of these animals indicate otherwise. In his foreword, Dr. Shuker's book, Dragons, A Natural History, Desmond Morris remarked, as recently as the 17th century, scholars wrote of dragons as though they were scientific fact, their anatomy and natural history being recorded in painstaking detail. Hogarth and Cleary agreed, saying no matter where they lived, everyone could describe dragons and dragon behavior in colorful, lurid detail. They continued, the evidence for dragons is not confined to work of natural history and literature, but appears in everyday chronicled events. And such eyewitness accounts are not derived from hearsay or anonymous rumor. They were set down by people of some standing, by kings and knights and monks and archbishops, scholars and saints. I just think it's fascinating. Earlier in we noticed Matthew Henry's commentary, who quoted another named Gill in 1766. He quoted another theologian from a previous century, Samuel Bocart, in which I know nothing about these guys, but the knowledge of others before me is interesting. And I've thought about this very, very much. I am a technician by trade, so the things that I repair, the things that I diagnose, I think about all the things that I've accumulated in knowledge, and oh yeah, this one burned me. It took me 3 days to find this problem, and now I know what I need to do. All of that stuff is hard to transmit to another person. It takes time to learn those things. Imagine if we just discount all the things that other people have reported. Then we begin to believe things aren't even real. We begin to believe as a society that God's not even real. So I think that's worth our time. GenesisPark.com commented further about those commentators that we're talking about. So while the Hebrew word nakash, forgive me for the pronunciation, is clearly the word for common snakes, these commentators that we were talking about from the 1600s, 1700s, have concluded that the compound word, seraphim, nakashim, should be translated fiery flying serpents. It would appear that the seraph was a reptilian snake-like creature, distinguished from common snakes predominantly by its ability to fly. Although I cannot be certain that the seraph is not some species unknown to us in either fossilized or extinct animals, I believe that the pterosaur identifies, and like the pterodactyl, identification is most reasonable. Indeed, this interpretation seems to fit the context quite well. These flying snakes or pterosaurs could have attacked and overcome the Israelites from the air. The winged serpent incorporates simultaneously the appearance of the snake and lofty ability of flight in a unique animal. And moreover, think about this. I thought it was point was well made when you think about the artist's rendition a moment ago. The outstretched pterosaur, if you think about a pterodactyl, on the pole would have formed the perfect cross. And didn't Jesus refer back to this very instance? And so as we draw to a conclusion, none of what we've read from external sources makes them true necessarily. I mean, they could have been telling a tall tale for their grandchildren. But it seems that these corroborate with some of the descriptions that God gave of Leviathan to Job. How interesting that is. The sheer numbers of comments, and I could only give you a few, really, from all different times in history and all across the globe are truly overwhelming. Paul and Barnabas and the apostles spoke to the people who wanted to make sacrifices to them as if they were gods. And they said, "We're men like you." Verse 17, "And yet he did not," speaking of God, "did not leave himself without witness, in that he did good and gave you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness." How true that is, that God gave us an overwhelming amount of things to be a witness that he is real, that he created those things. And I believe fire-breathing dragons were some of those that are yelling from the mountaintops of the power and the majesty of the Almighty, our Creator. I hope this is helpful to you. Did anybody have any comments before I close it down? All right. Thank you for being here, and God bless. We're adjourned.